Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter.
And thank you, everyone. This is Andrew Fetter, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. I have a very, very special guest. And I apologize right now, I have to close this
slider on the side.
Seems they're picking up the trash around here off time. Anyway, again, welcome to When Pigs Fly. And like I said, I have a very, very special guest that I think is going to be highly enlightening. It's not just enlightening. I feel like back in school and going back into studies with learning the most updated information of the sciences, and particularly with physics and quantum physics and at all. But before I do, I want to say to all those who are in Japan and affected by the earthquake, my thoughts and prayers go out to the families, friends, lovers, whatever, not really whatever, but that have been affected in Japan through the earthquake. That's quite devastating, and you know, truth bears out that, you know, it shows how we are just a speck on this earth. And it puts things in perspective, I think, and the reality of where we humans think that we have so much control that we really don't, that we are on this little crust called Earth. And we need to respect it. Anyway, I also want to make a quick announcement also. I know those out there in Australia and New Zealand, I've said multiple times, there is a great, great group of bands heading your way. Three in particular of some, they're actually some very heavyweight LA rock bands. I'm sure legends, you will know who they are. Quiet Riot, who have some, of course, Come Hear the Noise, and of course, Bang Your Head with Mental Health, along with Warrant, and of course, LA Guns. And they're heading out to Australia, New Zealand, like I have said previously. It's in April and May 2011. Check out Impact Intense Impact's website, intense-impact.com. And they will be playing in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth, Canberra, and Auckland. The dates and times and where they will be are there for you to look at, i.e., for example, they will be in Melbourne at the Palace on Friday the 29th in April, and they will be going through that tour until the tour through May 8th, in and around all through Australia. So do check those out, and there's direct links to Ticket Tech for those who are in Australia and in New Zealand through Ticketmaster. Feel free to check that out again. That's at www.intense-impact.com. Information is disclosed there, so feel free to check that out. I believe they also have links going straight to the shows themselves and everything else. So do check that out. I know you're going to love this concert. It is once in a lifetime to have three legend groups coming together like this, and it's very affordable for what it is. Now, for my special guest, I've been reading his book. It's called Visions in the Multi-Universe, which is it deals with physics, but I think it has a lot broader aspects of bringing things in fruition of science and understandings. And it is done in such a way, this book, I'm really honored to have him. It does it in such a way without, you don't have to know so much science. Let me put it that way. It is done so that anybody, even if you have no knowledge at all of anything, it's spoken in such a way that you can understand it. Plus, it's very readable into the, like, it's almost like you're sitting in a, you know, at the kitchen table and talking about aspects of physics in a fun way. Now, I'm honored to have Dr. Stephen Manley. And how are you, Stephen?
I'm good, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. I feel very honored to have you on. Seeing, like I said, all the information in your book. And it is interesting because you cover so many different aspects. And it was interesting that also you utilize the multi universe aspect, which to me, actually, I was thinking about it. First, I thought maybe you meant like the infinite ways in the universe, the multiple dimensions in one aspect, which I could, there's that part. And then I started thinking, and then I realized that toward the end of the book, and I'll tell you, I'll be honest, I read most of the book, and then I read the last half because I got, oh, I got to read that. Because most stuff I sort of understood. I know a little bit of quantum physics and stuff, so I skipped past that. I don't know much about string aspects of physics, but then I started, you know, going through it, and then I realized basically it's based upon the back to the perception issues of how all the aspects are, which goes back to it's like a round robin in a way. But I want to ask you, just give it briefly, because you do start off, and I think it was very poignant how you explain the differences between religion and science. And I personally think that there's also a greater influence of, and how that actually affected science, both with its mythology toward aspects of man and humanity and the lack of diligence toward doing proper research on women, of particular medical sciences, and our aspects of looking things at in a finite aspect as to the reality of a more of an infinite way of looking at things. How would you say you would disclose what is the difference between science and religion of today?
Well, I think that they have some real similarities in the sense that I think they're both born from humanity's desire to understand and explain and put what we see around us in some sort of a framework that seems to make sense to us. But there's a really deep difference between them. And science really has a particular methodology, which is, I tell my students, it bows before experiments. Science isn't necessarily married to the human bias. I mean, you might see something, you might make an observation, and it needs to be reproducible, and it may be surprising. It may, in fact, totally disagree with the preconception that you came in with, and you may make other measurements to confirm it. That's not to say every little scientific measurement that's made, everyone totally believes. I mean, science is made of people who are making measurements, and they all are arguing and doing new experiments and trying to converge on which ones they think really are right. But having said that, once that convergence happens, the concept that you carry with you, the model of the universe that you carry with you, has to be modified to be consistent with what you're seeing. So it doesn't really matter what it is. You might have to throw it out, and there are numerous examples of absolute major surprises in what we've seen in the universe around us, where when we threw out our preconceived notion or our bias, we made major, major advances in our understanding of the universe. And I know we'll come back to it later, so I don't want to get off on it now, but you know, relativity is an example where our whole concept of space and time got overthrown. Quantum mechanics is another example where, and so there are just numerous examples, and we have total revolutions in our understanding of the universe that come from this methodology. That said, you know, I see religion as very much a different thing, and you know, it's a matter of faith, right? Where you can choose to believe in it. I mean, where do you hear about it? Basically, these tend to be thoughts and ideas that are written down or passed to you from people you know or books or things like this, and they may or may not make sense to you. They may have more to them than science tries to do, and that religion often also comes with basically instructions on how to live a good life and maybe implications as to what might happen if you don't or what might happen if you do and things like that. And these are places where science really doesn't have anything to say, in a sense. So they're really very different ways of looking at the universe. And I know that there's a bit of a warfare between science and religion in some places because they do intersect sometimes. But I think they're really very distinct sorts of things.
But I think there, it's also, now when I say religion, I think that's more like on Western religions, because, and I didn't want to get into it, but now I thought about it. On Eastern religions, particularly with Taoism example, it interlinks between the sciences. It's not just based on sciences, it's based on observation. That's how basically a lot of the Taoists work. But, which is similar to the sciences. So in the Western, whether it's Islam, Christian, or Judaic, they're basically based upon faith alone, including, and also Hinduism and Buddhism, more or less. So, yeah.
Yeah, you're probably right in that. And it's also true that I've known scientists who basically use science as something of a religion, too, right?
Right, right. And then I've heard, like, when I talk to people, you know, like, you know, they have the approach, well, if I don't see it, how do I know it's there? I says, well, you don't exactly see radiation, do you? You know?
Right.
Oh, and then you have to prove it. Okay, well, how do you prove it? And then, you know, it's the methodologies. And I had, and I wanted to, this is another aspect I was going to get into, I want to get briefly into, because this is what I think, and I had another physicist on, and we talked briefly about it. But I wanted to get your input, because me looking how science is approaching and what I think the problem is, my view is on my problem, and I'm not even a scientist. I did have science background. I worked in the Mann laboratories when I was a kid, way back when they were doing the earlier days of DNA research and all that stuff. But I thought, and it always got to me, if the universe has worked on probability and approximation, and the universe is really in reality, in its aspects of an infinite nature, because in reality, how far do you go down? Small, and how far you go large? How far small is a particle? When you get into all aspects where everything's sort of a, you know, mass equals matter, it's one and the same, and there's the particle and wave issue. There's always this, and then the multiple dimensional area of space and time and all that stuff. In reality, it's becoming more infinitely based. We're coaching where that's the reality. That is the reality, which is ironic with the shamanism and the Kabbalism and the Sufi and who else and the Taoists. They all look at things sort of like that in that aspect. And what blew me away is how come we're still working on the methodology of a finite based of experimentation, as opposed to using an experimentation using an infinite approach. Which maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they are starting to utilize a more infinite approach of both with, I know they're doing some aspect, but it seems that's still locked into a finite way of observation and experiments. Therefore, you're going to produce a finite understanding, which in a way is sort of an illusion of what the reality of the experiment is.
Well, we may always be stuck with that because we have our own limitations, right? I mean, in science, there is a convergence between what we understand of the very small and the very large, so the quantum processes and how they play into the large-scale structure of the universe. And you do have the wave-particle thing, and space and time are not as crisp as they used to be. So I guess I'm no expert on Eastern religions and thought and things like that, but I could imagine there are certainly some similarities. But in the end, you have the methodology of science is to be able to make a concrete statement about something based on an observation. And so you're always going to come down to the human individual who dreams up, from the framework we have, who dreams up a particular observation, which may have its limitations. I mean, I'll give you one example. We do have wave particle duality in quantum mechanics. We sort of know that particles can act as waves and as particles. And the thing is, when we're doing experiments, generally we're sort of limited into sort of perceiving them one way or the other. It's really hard to sort of do it all at the same time, in a sense. So if you're doing optics, for example, and you're looking you're generally using the wave aspects of well, it depends on the type of optics. But if you're very often you're looking at the wave aspects of light, and yet then there are other things like atomic spectroscopy and things like that where you really have to think of light in terms of its particle characteristics. But it's sort of hard to do both.
So that's what I was trying to get to there, sort of interwoven. But let me go into the basics of some of the aspects that you got into within my within your book that I have questions about. And one in particular is in regards to, you know, so that, because a lot of my listeners may not have any basis of understanding a lot of the physics. It's sort of like, oh my God, it's all, you know, like a chalkboard aspects. And I reiterate, like in your book, you took away because I remember like professors, they'd just be jotting away on the chalkboard and then they walk away and you're looking like, okay, and with this huge, equations on there simplified in a certain way, and then you got to figure it all out. And you did it in a very easy way of understanding for some.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because that was the whole point. I mean, my view of my skill set is that I try to make things more accessible than the general science book that's out there. Remains to be seen if there's a market for that, but I think there's a place for it, and I hope that I'm glad to hear that you may have seen it that way, and I hope some of your listeners will too.
Well, I think it was Einstein who said anybody can make something more complex. It takes a genius to make something more simplified. So I'm not paraphrasing. So anyway, let's go into just really briefly. I want to go into some of the aspects, and you just go, you know, I'll just throw them out there, and then you just throw a very brief explanation of what they are. I think that, like you just brought about space, time, and I believe a lot of people really need to learn. I think a lot of people out there look at space and time as a separate item, and yet they're really in reality one and the same. Not one and the same. There's a collision course of what they are, sort of speak. They work together.
They do. Yeah. So I have a favorite way of trying to explain how wacky I usually start with time. How wacky time can be. It is a little bit easier on a whiteboard, but we'll see what we can do here with the phone. So imagine that a train is going by, and there's a person on the train who has a little flashlight at the bottom of the floor of the train, and they send light straight up to the ceiling, and it comes straight back down. So from their point of view, they're on the train. You know how when you're on a train or a car, if it's on smooth road or rails, you don't actually feel that you're moving. So this person is moving with the flashlight, and in fact, they would perceive the light to go straight up and straight back down. And they could measure how much time that takes in principle. And of course, it'd be terribly hard to do. But in principle, they could measure how long it takes. And if you know the height of the car, you could actually determine the speed of light, right? So because speed is just the distance it goes over the time it takes for it to go that distance. So they could measure the speed of light, and they would get a certain value. Now, the thing is, and this was a bit of a surprise, but it's an example of science, the methodology of science being at work. The speed of light is the same no matter who you are, how you measure it, no matter how you're moving. And that may sound really weird if you stop and really think about it, because our world doesn't really so much operate that way. And here, one example I use is suppose you had, and I know nobody does this, but suppose you have some sort of bad guy teenager, right, who wants to throw a bottle at a mailbox. Now, if he's standing out by the mailbox, you can throw a bottle at the mailbox, and it doesn't do a whole lot, because all you can do is throw it however hard you can throw. But if you go zipping by that mailbox on a very fast-moving car and you throw the bottle at the mailbox, you can destroy the mailbox, right? Why? Because the bottle is going faster, because it's basically emitted by something that's moving. Now, the odd thing is, if you do exactly the same sort of thing, except you're doing it with light instead of the bottle, whether you're standing beside the mailbox or whether you're zooming by in a car, the light actually goes the same speed. So it's very counterintuitive, but it's one of those things that when you go and you actually look in our world, that's what you see. And given this fact, if we go back to our train example, so just to remind you, we have some guy on the train, and he's on the train. The light goes straight up, straight back down. He can calculate the speed of light, and he gets some number, which is a big number, but we'll just call it C. If you imagine now that you are off to the side of the train tracks and you watch the train go by and you try to make that same measurement, when the light leaves the flashlight and it is traveling up to the ceiling, the train actually moves forward, which means you see the light hit the ceiling at a point that is a little bit beyond where the light was emitted. And then when it comes back down, again, it's a little bit beyond where it was, where it bounced off the ceiling. So your perception would be you would see the light sort of go up, but in the form of like a triangle. It would sort of have to go up and then meet the ceiling a little bit further down the tracks and then come back and hit the floor a little bit further down the tracks, because it has to come back and hit the floor at the same point where it was emitted, because that is physically what has to happen with the beam of light. So if you're off to the side of the train, you would actually see the light travel a distance that is different from the distance that the guy on the train saw, because instead of going straight up and down, you'd see it go on this triangular path with the same height, if you can get that picture. If it goes this a bigger distance, you could measure a time. If the speed of the light has to be the same in both cases, it turns out that it will take more time for the light to travel its path if you're off to the side of the train than it does if you're on the train. It's a much easier thing to do graphically on the whiteboard, but if you could visualize that, you get these two examples of two people looking at exactly the same thing, and because the speed of light is constant in each case, just from point of view, it turns out that you can infer that time has to pass at a different rate for the two people. And this is basically what Einstein discovered with this theory of special relativity. What he found was that the passage of time, when you compare one point of view to another, we call them reference frames. So typically, when you compare observations between people that are moving with respect to one another, you find that time flows at different rates. And you might wonder, you know, this could be a real problem, right? You might need to adjust your commuting speed and things like that so you can get to work on time if everybody's clock runs at a different rate. It turns out that when you look at the mathematics of how this happens, the effect is only big when the relative speed between the two points of view is pretty large compared to the speed of light. But our bias, you know, everybody's bias is really different from this. So this is a complete revolution, right? We all have a vision of space and time, which is that space is a three-dimensional, immutable thing that is moving one-dimensionally, lockstep, through time, you know, in one direction, and the same for everybody. So whether you're flying in a fighter jet or on the ground, if we synchronize our clocks and we wait an hour and we come back together, all of our watches will be 1 hour later. But what Einstein found was that's not true with time. And, you know, I'm not going to bore you with the examples, but you can do a similar sort of thing and find out that space also changes. A measurement of length also changes depending on your point of view.
Yeah, so, yeah, it was like the aspect I think you pointed out, because I know people don't wear that. Like, I know astronauts, if they start going, let's say, to the moon and they start going pretty far out, their watches would be different than the watches on Earth.
Yeah, well, and this isn't hypothetical science fiction crap. This is stuff that we've been doing experiments on for 100 years, and we know it to be true. And in fact, it's more than that. We use it every day. If you use your GPS, the GPS system, which is based on signals from satellites orbiting out in space, if you do not make relativistic corrections to the numbers, you cannot achieve the accuracy that we achieve with the GPS system. So that's a place where relativity feeds directly into your everyday life, for example, and makes, you know, that makes a big difference. That kind of system is used very much in the military and communications and transportation and all sorts of things. So it's very important to us.
And let me ask, because I want to get into some other aspects really, and very briefly. I know we went into a little bit of this, but that was a really good point. I want to ask you, you talked a little bit about the wave and particle wave issues aspects. Can you just very briefly explain in quantum mechanics the understandings of the particle wave issue?
Sure, I can give it a go. To me, the story sort of begins in the mid-1880s, where there was a guy named James Clerk Maxwell who basically took everything that had been discovered about electricity and magnetism up to that point, and he managed to put all of this knowledge into four equations. And when he looked at these equations, he saw that they predicted basically something that had the characteristics of light, and in fact it is light. And what we find is that light is made up of what we call electric and magnetic fields. So basically those things that we use to model electricity and we use to model magnetism, when you put them in these equations, it turns out that these quantities seem to oscillate. And when they oscillate, they sort of self-propagate. So an electric field will oscillate and create a magnetic field, which will oscillate and create an electric field, and all of this thing will actually propagate out at the speed of light. So this is sort of neat and a big surprise, I think, of sorts, and a very magical moment in physics, because it basically, Maxwell's equations hold the actual key to light, but they have a very, very particular form. The equations themselves are wave equations. They describe light using mathematics that is exactly like the mathematics you would use to describe a wave traveling on a string for a musical instrument, or a wave traveling in the ocean, for example. The math is very distinct, and they're all the same. And then it implies that light will exhibit characteristics that waves typically exhibit, and it does. And so just one example is, if you're in the ocean, for example, and two waves hit you at the same time, they sort of add together and you get lifted up twice as high as you normally would. But if they hit you, you know, if the trough of one wave hits you when the crest of another hits you, you basically don't move at all. And this is a way that waves add. It's called interference, and light exhibits exactly the same thing. And there are a number of other characteristics. So by the end of the 1800s, physicists completely understood light in terms of its wave characteristics, and it really, really is a wave. And then it turned out that there were several different things that, when they examined them, they found they could not explain using the wave theory. So one of them was basically how the light from things that are glowing comes out. So if you heat something up, you know, it glows, and you can look at how the color of that light, how the intensity of the light changes with color. And when physicists really studied that in great detail, they couldn't model it using the wave theory. And a guy named Max Planck assumed that light came in little particles in order to actually explain that phenomenon. And at first, people really didn't believe in that model, but the mathematics was correct. He was able to describe what we saw in terms of the mathematical formula that showed the intensity and how it varied with color. But then later on, Einstein explained something else called the photoelectric effect using the same idea that light comes in little particles. And all of a sudden, when you started getting multiple things that were not explainable with the wave picture that were perfectly well explained with particles, people began to take it seriously. And then at some point in the 1920s, a guy named Louis de Broglie hypothesized, well, if light has wave and particle characteristics, maybe particles have wave and particle characteristics. And it turned out that that could be used to model the discrete nature of how light is emitted by atoms. It turns out that a given type of atom does not emit one color, a broad spectrum of colors of light. It actually will emit only very discrete colors when you look at it carefully. This is why neon lamps, for example, aren't white, they're actually bright orange, and that's because neon emits light preferentially with, you know, a very discrete wavelength, which is orange. At any rate, once people realized that particles could be waves, they had to develop whole new way of looking at things, which took into account the wave nature of the particles. And this is what we call quantum mechanics. And it has met with enormous success in explaining many, many things out there. So it appears that although we have a bias that things are either particles or waves, okay, something looks like a BB and I know exactly where it is, or it looks like a big wave in the ocean or something, and then, you know, where is that wave? You can sort of point to it generally, but you can't really pin down where the center of it is. So these are very different ways of looking at the world, and to us, they're really quite distinct. But nature has no such hang-ups, apparently. Apparently, so particles and waves can be both particles and waves, so...
So, instead of duality, to me, it's almost like symbiotic in its way of looking at it. But let me ask you this: there's also the aspect of what you in your book, which was pretty poignant, was which is really cool that you did it, because people think of physics and they actually think of physics like the Newtonian way of looking at physics. Until, of course, when it gets to electrons and photons, then that doesn't work. And that's when the probability factors come in, which is where quantum physics falls into the place. Am I correct?
Yeah. So that's exactly right. I mean, if you want to talk about a particle going through a small opening, in the Newtonian world, you would think of that particle more like a BB, and you know exactly where it is at any given time. But the minute that you say particles can have wave characteristics, then waves, when they go through small openings, actually spread out on the other side. And you have to now put that into the idea for particles as well. So it's a totally different way of looking at things.
And is there any is there any gravitational forces keeping the electrons in their proper or in their fluctuating orbits, so to speak, around, you know, the center of the, you know, the neutrons and whatnot, that it's orbiting?
Yeah, so the force that holds the electrons in is the basically the electric force, or we call it the electromagnetic force. Gravity is there, but it is about 10 to the power of 40 times weaker than gravity, than electromagnetism, maybe 10 to the 35th. But it's gravity, even though it is ever present in your life and my life, and we're always sort of struggling against it, it is the weakest of the four basic forces of nature that we understand, not by a small bit, but by like a factor of 10 to the 35. It's really tiny in terms of strength.
Well, it would have to be, otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be in our body, we would be blob.
Well, we'd be a mess, that's for sure.
Yeah, because, you know, that would keep our atoms together, which keeps our cells together, which keeps even, you know, every aspect around the world here. So it has to be, that would be the countering obvious force. And then there's issue, I know, and then you got into a little bit aspect of it with the probability of things, which quantum physics does, which gets into the variances that things are not exact. We sort of guess. You give an approximation where the electrons are, you don't know where they're really orbiting or how they're orbiting. You're sort of estimating a probability where they might be, which to people go like, huh? It's like, you know, it's maybe there, maybe not, but it is.
Well, it's a very different way of looking at things. And it turns out that when you develop this theory of quantum mechanics where you're trying to look at particles as waves, well, I say trying, where it is done and done very successfully. It turns out that quantum mechanics has in it inherently some uncertainty, which limits our knowledge about things, but it also can be very empowering. But if we talk about what you were just mentioning, there's inherently uncertainty in where something is. I cannot calculate for a given event, or for, let's say, a particle is moving along, I can't calculate exactly where it is in any given moment. All I can get out of quantum mechanics is the probability distribution of where it might be. So I have a sort of a silly example that I use to sort of describe the difference. Let's suppose that you threw a party every Tuesday and and you were inviting one of your friends, say, hey, I throw parties every Tuesday. I want you to come by. And your friend, instead of saying, yeah, I'll come by, or yeah, I won't, they say, okay, there's a 20% probability that I'll come by. All right? You and your friend, if this is a quantum mechanical world, cannot know whether they'll actually come by or not. All you would actually know is if after 100 weeks, if you threw 100 parties, your friend would have shown up for about 20 of them. But you would never know ahead of time which one they would actually show up for. And there would be no way for you to calculate or predict it. So it's a very different sort of strange world in quantum mechanics, this whole probability business.
Let me ask you another aspect. There's another issue. Well, I was going to jump into one thing, but I think I want to ask you this because this is my own personal question, I guess, when I have to ask this. What is the Copenhagen understanding of quantum physics?
Okay, so let's use your friend at a party example. If we were mathematically modeling that, then all we would know is that your friend has this 20% probability of showing up for the party at any given time. But the minute you see your friend walk through the door, you know with 100% certainty that they're at that party, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're trying to mathematically model your friend's appearance at the party, for example, then we have to go from basically a mathematical function that is sort of diffuse, that is, it sort of has this 20% probability, to one that has 100% probability instantaneously. And in quantum mechanics, we would call that a wave function collapse. Maybe this isn't the best example for it. Generally, I guess the example I usually use is suppose we send a particle through a thin opening. That particle, if it's a wave, will spread out, which means when it hits the wall back behind that thin opening, you don't know exactly where it's going to hit. This phenomenon is called diffraction. And what that would mean is if we're modeling the particle using a wave function, we would have a non-zero probability of it hitting somewhere on the wall back behind that slit, but we wouldn't know exactly where until it actually hit the wall. The moment it hit the wall, then we would know exactly where it is. But because the area of the wall is potentially very large, basically you go from a mathematical function that covers the large area to one that's concentrated at that single point with 100% probability, and you do it instantaneously. So this is known as wave function collapse, and it's a very bizarre... It basically is breaks causality. It seems that you have faster than light information travel because you're going from something big to something local in an absolute instant. And so this is a bit bothersome to people, right? It's a way of looking at it that actually works in quantum mechanics, but it's got this causal problem in the wave function collapse that bothers people. So Copenhagen interpretation is, well, the modeling works really, really well, so we shouldn't worry about this wave function actually collapsing because we can never actually see the wave function. All we can really see is that particle when it hits the detector on the wall. And so we're not going to worry so much about what happens prior to that. And we're just going to go ahead and let this wave function collapse instantly. So that's what the Copenhagenists say.
Right, but what happens with, and this is where I'm leading into, is the aspect of observation. Isn't that affected by the wave function collapse issue? Is influence of the observer causing the outcome?
Well, it is true that the observer basically becomes part of the problem, or the actual the detection becomes part of the problem. So it's really hard to separate the observer from the observed and the detector in quantum mechanical problems. you know, people have through the years talked about it's the awareness of the event that maybe causes the collapse, but I think it's actual the physically when the particle interacts with stuff in the wall, that's when the wave function collapse actually happens. And there are experiments where you can, for example, there are certain types of experiments that you can run where the act of observation seems to collapse the wave function. And people have gotten hung up sort of thinking of that as being the conscious knowledge of what's going on as being the thing that can affect the wave function. But I think, in fact, the actual act of making any sort of observation of the particle that gives you more information will cause that wave function to collapse. So, you know, even if you feel like you're doing it non-destructively, that is, you're not actually stopping the particle, but you're just, you know, maybe making it go by a wire where you would get a little electrical signal and know that it went through one slit instead of another if you were doing an experiment with two slits trying to figure out which one it goes through. That little perturbation is enough to actually collapse the wave function.
I want to ask you now, there's three more questions directly, specifically on physics, and then I want to get into some aspects where there's a, you know, how they would correlate on a different approach. But there's another thing that I've read, and I don't recall seeing it in your book, but I've read it in other things. It's called the Einstein versus Bohr issues of uncertainty. And then there was delegated where Bohr proved within his science that actually Einstein and his thinking was actually one of the things that Einstein, which is a very rarity, was turned to be incorrect. And that was with the Heisenberg uncertainty person, so if I'm not correct. So, you know, it was the issue, I think it was the things that are developed as chance as opposed to things that happen. And I think Einstein left out the issue of influence of will and choice within the aspects of the uncertainty principle, which Bohr pointed out that there, I believe. Am I not correct?
So I'll talk a little bit about the things that I know and believe. I don't consider myself a super historical expert on the conversations between Einstein and Bohr, but I do know that Einstein was bothered by the lack of what we would call determinism in quantum mechanics. And it appears that in quantum mechanics there is at its very core this lack of determinism. So this is quantified best in what is known as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And it's really tied up with the whole wave-like nature of matter. You cannot know with an infinite precision both exactly where a wave is or how fast it's moving. And so this gets quantified in quantum mechanics in the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It basically says your knowledge of the of where an object is, that is your lack of knowledge, your error in where it is, times the error in how fast it's going, or better, we call it the momentum of it, is these two things multiplied together have to be bigger than some really tiny number. So what that really means is if I know exactly where something is, I don't know its momentum very well, and if I know exactly its momentum or how fast it's going, then I don't know where it is very well. And in Newtonian world, I could in principle know where they both are very, very, very well. So again, this is something that when things are very large, it turns out not to be something that bothers us very much because we can't really measure things to that level of precision that it would be bothersome. But when a particle is really tiny, this turns out to be a big deal. So an example I often use is suppose you wanted a car were zipping by and you wanted to know where it was and how fast it was moving. What would you do? I mean, you could get like a policeman's laser speed gun, I guess. And you could basically bounce a photon off that car in a couple of different places. And if you knew the direction the photon was going initially and you knew the time between the photons being bounced off the car, you could basically measure exactly where the car is and how fast it's going. And in principle, you could do this with arbitrary precision, and that's the Newtonian world. But suppose now you try to do that with a little electron. A photon has a lot of energy, and when you hit an electron with a photon, it basically blasts it, and you would change the momentum of the photon. You would change its direction. You might change its speed. And so you might bounce a photon off the electron, but when you do, you're going to mess the electron up. And so this is a way that's a practical way of saying that you have this Heisenberg uncertainty principle. I can't invent an experiment where I can know both where and the momentum of the particle to infinite precision. And this has a philosophical issue in the sense that in the Newtonian world, if I had a big enough computer, enough computing resources, and I input into that computer the location of every particle in the universe, how fast it was going, and what the forces were on it, I could predict the future without any problem. But in the quantum mechanical world, I can't actually put all that information in because I can't actually know it all. I might be able to put the position of every particle, but the minute I do that, I don't know how fast they're going.
Right,
we can't actually predict the future anymore if you believe in quantum mechanics. So that's sort of a philosophical thing. But
right.
there are other things of great import in this, because there's another form of the uncertainty principle that says I can't know the energy of a system, and well, that the shorter lived a system is, the less my knowledge of its energy, basically. And so what this means is that I can effectively break conservation of energy if I do it over a short enough time, which may sound a little bit wacky, because basically I can say a Volvo appeared in my office, but then it disappeared and it happened over so short a time that you could never observe it. And you go, whoa, you're ready for the straitjacket. But it turns out that in quantum mechanics, if I want to describe something like a particle moving through a vacuum, I have to add together all of the possibilities. And what this opens up is the possibility that that particle can change into other particles, effectively breaking conservation of energy. It doesn't really, because it's still within the rules of quantum mechanics. But effectively, I can break conservation of energy with this particle changing into other particles so long as they come back together over a very short time. And I can't actually see that happen, but when I'm calculating in quantum mechanics what that particle's characteristics are, I have to take all these possibilities into account, which means in the world of quantum mechanics, I don't really view a particle like a BB. I view it as a diffuse cloud of possibilities. We call them virtual particles. And again, that might sound sort of only academic interest, but this turns out to be the model that we have in our fundamental theories of forces. We call it quantum field theory. If I have two particles and I exchange one of these sort of fictitious virtual particles, I actually exchange momentum, and that is what we call a force. So in quantum field theory, which is a very well-respected, well-functioning, well-supported, and backed-up scientific theory, this is the actual conceptual view of a force. So it's a little bit weird, but the electromagnetic force in this theory is really an exchange of what we call virtual photons, so these sort of cloud of particles that only can exist due to the uncertainty principle. So although we have indeterminism in quantum mechanics and sort of give up our ability to really super well predict the future, we gain for that this strange uncertainty that we can use to be the basis of quantum field theory. So it's a funny sort of liberating thing.
Let me ask you this, I need to ask you real briefly, because I have like some other questions that some of my listeners definitely want to get and I want to get to. Really briefly, what exactly is string physics?
Oh, string theory. Well, it turns out that if you were to model particles as little points, let's just imagine the two points coming together. when they come together, the distance between them goes to zero. And there are many quantities that we're modeling in physics that, for example, have a force that goes as one over that distance. Well, if that distance is going to zero, then as these particles approach each other, that force or whatever it is becomes infinite. So the mathematics runs into trouble when particles actually can go to zero distance. So people started modeling particles as little finite strings, little lengths of string, and had them actually vibrate. You can have resonant vibrations just like you can on a guitar. And they would look at these different energies of these different resonant vibrations, and it turned out that the mathematics, when they did this carefully, the mathematics actually was very similar to how particles were described in quantum field theory. So the idea was that you could model particles in terms of vibrations on these different types of strings. And things sort of took off from there. It turns out that it's a potentially very, very powerful technique. One of the things they discovered in this was that one of the types of particles they produced actually had the characteristics that you would want for a particle if you were creating a quantum theory of gravity, that is, if you interpreted gravity as being an exchange of a particle in the same way I was sort of describing for electromagnetism. And it turns out we don't have a working theory of gravity in that way, so this was a big deal, and people got very excited about it. And they've done lots of work since. There was hope for many years this might be the basis of a theory of everything, in part because it would marry the ideas of quantum field theory with the ideas of general relativity, which actually was our theory of gravity, which isn't quantized. So that was sort of the idea. It's evolved much beyond strings now, though. They actually have other types of topological things in the theory. So it's not just a string theory. They have, you know, big three-dimensional structures and things.
Right. But, you know, it's interesting that you brought the way you talk about that. What's interesting about that is exactly the way aspects within Kabbalah and also I Ching is they both look with numbers having referring to frequencies, and that all things have frequencies, almost like a string as a pattern. And that's what the numerology, the real numerology within Kabbalism and also I Ching, everything has frequencies. All matter, all energy has frequencies of energy, and it's that's where they come with the numerological references, which is pretty interesting. So anyway, I want to ask you some now into some questions. Where now we're going to move from physics to the I guess esoterics, and what if I name a few things. What would be, as you as a physicist would look at it, or what they see in physics, outlook at it. Like, for example, what is the soul in physics?
What is the what?
What is the soul? I mean, the human soul.
Spell it. Oh, the soul. The soul.
Not like soul, man.
Well, I mean, that's not something I think about in physics.
That's what really surprises me, that a lot of we're looking at everything outside, but the funniest thing is that I don't understand this. Is what I never understood. Why didn't they all in physics? I mean, I tried finding out with even the Einstein stuff, and every book about physics. How come they don't look in the mirror and go, they've never just studied what the hell a soul is?
Well, I mean, I'm a person, and so, you know, it's not as if I don't have personal ideas of sort of soul and you know, the fact that humans are have passion and are different and there's consciousness. I mean, people are trying to understand scientifically what consciousness is all about. As a physicist, I mean, perhaps people have tried to make some measurements or whatever, but we are limited. We don't understand what the soul is. I mean, I don't think we really understand what consciousness is yet. But people are trying to get at things. I mean, there are people who are making studies of detailed things happening in the brain, right? And trying to associate that with conscious thought.
Right, but they're doing it from, like, what I'm saying is they're looking on one aspect is physiologically on the aspect of just, you know, what you see and observe, as opposed to, like, you see, you just brought up a point, because I know there's, the reason I was being facetious about not looking, because I know they have looked at it, because I've read, there's famous things that are written by Einstein talking about it, and he was trying to figure out what dreams are, and what, you know, and all that stuff, and conscious, and create, what is really creativity, even, he was trying to figure out. So
I think people really are fascinated by it, but there is a difference, right? In terms of how a scientist might look at it versus how some other people might, and I do talk about it a little bit in the book, because it comes up a little bit with quantum mechanics. As a scientist, I guess I would be of the philosophy that whatever is happening in our minds, I would view as being married in some way to the physical processes that are actually happening in the brain itself. So I would think of it as fundamentally being electrochemical in nature and the moving around of electrochemical impulses and chemistry and stuff like that. You know, that's not to say I can just do a little chemistry in the lab and feel like I understand thought. I believe that it does happen that you can have emergent properties in complex systems, which is basically what I think of as life. But as a scientist, and this is where science begins to verge on religion a little bit, because I can't say this with any scientific certainty, but it just seems to be, it fits well in my whole idea of the scientific world. We tend to assume that there's a reasonable physical explanation behind things, okay? As a physicist, if you discovered something else, my first reaction wouldn't be, oh, how mystically cool that is. My reaction would be, oh, what is the nature of the force then if it's not electromagnetic? There's evidence for something new. I want to understand it, right? So that's how I would look at it.
Okay, because I know they've, I've heard, and I'll give you an example, because I know they've had done measurements on thoughts, for example, and they've figured out that their thoughts actually produce some sort of energy or feel or something, and I know they've did studies on that, and I know that they're trying to, and not just electromagnetically, but it's outside thoughts or somehow in another, and they're trying to figure out with that, but there is a, they've been detecting that, and then there's a famous thing that was done a few years ago with they took a tissue of somebody, and I'm trying to remember the process, but it was done several times, and they took the DNA of somebody, and they put them in, let's say, like New York. I'm just giving an example because I don't know exactly the experiment, but I knew of the experiment. And then they put a lie detector which tests the motions of that tissue, and the same lie detector sort of complex on the person. And then what they found was amazingly identical reactions of emotions.
Huh. Well, news to me. You're well outside the kind of stuff that I do professionally. So I haven't heard of these
so things. That's what they were trying to figure out with the DNA and the connection between. And then so they knew there was a connection somehow, but they don't know how that's connected. Which goes into a lot of the aspects within your book, which I found very unique, because within your book, and I was going to read them off, but it were too much time. But I'd rather let people go get the book and read it than me having you read, go through a lot. And you do touch on certain things that relate to these things. And one is, I think, with the soul issue, and you talked about that was one multi-universe thing, and then the dreams, and then consciousness. And of course, manifesting is actually creating with thoughts, some believe, and I particularly believe, and the ability to creation, which is the more of a quantum way, if you want to call it that, of the probability of creating things happening. And I think those are the aspects that if we do start getting closer to understanding, where physics, which this is what I feel, is physics is sort of going, I believe, is doing a full circle, and including science. Coming not just the organized religion of thought, but a thought that was actually understandings that was purposely, and I hate to say used purposely, but it actually was, pushed down from the understandings of what some people would call shamanism, of understandings, and they didn't know why it was working, but aspects that were working, utilize of our universe, which they knew happened, but they didn't know why. And
so there are people out there who say, for example, that somehow the mind is causing wave function collapse or selection of emergent threads in a mini world sort of quantum mechanics, and sort of in a sense, and they say this is pushed in, for example, What the Bleep Do We Know, and as a movie, where they talk about basically the mind creating reality. In my book, I'm actually arguing against that. I don't see any evidence for that. There's a different way of looking at things, this many worlds idea, along with an idea called decoherence, which actually doesn't require, or in fact, I mean, there's no evidence that the mind actually is part of it. And what I argue is that, in fact, the mind itself, if you were to believe that the mind is limited to electrochemical processes, you can actually look at the time frame over which those things happen and realize that the mind can't be playing a role in creating the quantum reality around us. If you believe the mind is outside of electrochemical processes, then you're in the realm of new things that, to me, I'm unaware of scientific evidence for. Now, you were alluding to a few things that I've never heard of, this tissue experiment or whatever, so I'm not saying I know everything that's going on out there, and I hope we don't know everything about the universe. I'm pretty sure we don't. But I don't think modern science is supporting this idea that reality is created by our consciousness.
Okay, I'll give you an example where they did actually do it's actually a famous thing. I lived in Israel when it actually happened, and then they did it again when the riots broke out. But there was actually, they took a group of people into near Israel, actually, during when the Lebanese War was happening in the 80s. And these people just focused using sort of like transcendental thought or whatever you want to call it for peace in that particular area. And they just focused on it, whatever. And it was a group of people. I don't remember how many, but there was a group. And this was actually a study that was done way back when. And then for that small period while they did it, there was absolutely no violence. It was bizarre. So I thought, okay, maybe it was just a coincidence. So they did a double take. They took the same group of people, another group of people, not the same. And they did sort of the exact same way of doing their own the meditation. They were actually doing transcendental meditation. And they did it during when the riots broke out in Los Angeles during the 90s. And the same exact thing happened where all of a sudden, well, violence stopped for like a day or two or whatever. And they noticed there was a coincidence. And then they started realizing, that was breaking into the area. They're trying to figure out, is this coincidence or something outside? And then they're trying to develop the understanding that there is perhaps a measurement, thoughts and things. That our thoughts are actually things outside, and that's where the issue of science is. We've limited our focus, like you just said, the as a mechanical basis of electrons and stuff and things like that. But then if you meet people who have had like, and this may sound bizarre, but of having understandings like there's no way they could understand them, like past lives or issues. There's actually facts, for example. Famous rabbi called they call him the Ari, and how he could know, like for example, a lot of the Kabbalistical writings literally by heart. In fact, there's a famous one called the Zohar, which they think he was like the reincarnate, if you want to call it that. So how would he know exactly what this other person wrote almost 300-400 years before he was alive, know exactly the same things without even picking up the book?
I've heard of some of these sorts of things. I mean, if we talk about the studies of stopping bombs, I mean, or get people in a room and they think a certain thing and it stops something. Part of the problem is that's not a scientific experiment. You can pick days where bombs don't actually go off, right? And so you have to do things in a very reproducible sort of way and do a statistical analysis, and it has to be very careful. And so when you're using with human subjects and things like this, running actual controlled experiments like this is very hard to do. I've never heard of such a thing like that I mean, I haven't studied this. This is not what I do for a living, but I haven't heard of a thing like that that passed the scientific muster, you know, of the kind of rigorous tests that we would make on any real hard scientific result. Something like this rap, I mean, I don't even know what to say about that, right? I mean, that's not a scientific experiment. I mean, I don't know if it's true or not. What do I know about it? I hear you saying it. You read it somewhere. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. I don't know the guy. I've certainly never measured 10 of them, right? So it just, it makes it, it's interesting. And if I had experience and ran into some of these examples, then it might be something that would get my mind going where I would try to design an experiment to see if I could understand what's going on. But other than that, it's sort of just anecdotal stuff I hear about, and I shrug, and I don't even know what to think about it as a scientist.
Well, because I've read in the past a lot of letters that, I mean, Einstein was talking about issues of this too. He was saying there's aspects of, like, thoughts and that are things, and then creativity the same. He also had an idea that the soul is not really, as what you were talking about, that there's actually a separate variance of consciousness, not part of the physical body. So then, you know, and he was alluding to that. Excuse me, I should use the word.
Yeah.
Well, but he couldn't. That he was. That's what he was so perplexed. He was trying to use a mathematical and experimental way of trying to put that together. But then I know there was some studies that he was just touching upon, and it's been kept sort of a hush hush to some extent. But they were talking about, you know, mind versus matter issues and thoughts and creation of things. And in his belief that there was, to some extent, that there is the possibility of that.
Well, I mean, I'm no expert on you know, Einstein's thoughts along these directions, but you have to, scientists are people, and a scientist can speculate on things as much as anybody else could, but that's very different from what they actually do experiments on and publish about, right? I mean, I might have opinions about religion, but that doesn't mean I publish scientific papers with those opinions, because any opinion I have that's basically on religion, it doesn't fit scientific methodology. So those are sort of very different kinds of statements. So you have to forgive Einstein if he, you know, if he speculates on the nature of the soul. I mean, that's cool and everything, but that's not the same as his relativity, which is scientifically supportable.
Oh, okay. In other words, we're getting into the faith base as opposed to actually proven within a scientific.
And that's true in this book. I mean, there are a number of different ideas about multiple universes that really are more opinion based than they are anything else. I mean, you can sort of believe in them or not, and I lay some of them out. But there are other ideas, for example, about the multiple universe that are actually inferred from real scientific theories. The weird thing about multiple universes, you'll never be able to step outside of our universe to actually prove their existence, in a sense, because by definition, if it's a multiple universe, it's outside of our experience. It's because if it were inside our experience, it'd be part of our universe. So I do sort of touch on some of these ideas in the book.
Well, let me ask you this, because we're coming to a head, and how could somebody get in touch? Do you have a website, and what is your and where can somebody access and get your book?
Well, they can just Google me, Stephen with a V, Manly, M-A-N-L-Y, and they'll find my professional website, the University of Rochester, which I need to update. I don't know how exciting they'll find it. It just basically has my teaching stuff and some references to some of the particle physics research, which is sort of my main line of research. The book itself is available, standard outlets like Amazon or Barnes & Noble or things like that. I mean, it's out in the world. So they can. It's by New Page Books. They can order it there as well.
I want to thank you for coming on my show. It's extremely informative. I mean, from A to Z, we started from beginning physics 101 to a little bit more of a quasi into speculation of faith.
Well, that so, we did. We actually covered more background than multiverses. So in the book, I give a survey of different multiple universe ideas and try to make that very accessible. And so you and I didn't manage to actually talk much about that, but we did talk about some cool stuff. So I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, and I that's why I definitely want people definitely to check out this book. Again, you can check it on Amazon. I will try to put that link. I'll find it on Amazon, find the link, and I'll put it on my page so that people can access it for you. And I'll try to even give you a little review there because I think it's a 5-star. And I don't usually do reviews for people, but I will do it for this such. But again, I want to thank you for coming on my show. It was really an honor to have you on, and thanks.
Well, my pleasure, Andrew.
And thank you, everybody, for listening, and God bless you all, and have a glorious, glorious weekend. And God bless all the victims and those associated in the earthquake. My thoughts and prayers go out to you. Again, thank you, and...